listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake Up Hollywood, this is your host of the most, Nikki Corulla. We're going to jump right into this interview. This is why I have a radio show, to show off my amazingly talented friends. Please welcome Mr. Scott Little. How are you, Scott?
I'm good, brother. How about you?
Good, man. I know it's 7 o'clock for you. Is it hot in Atlanta right now?
No. I mean, I did wear shorts today, but I wouldn't call it hot. But it won't be long.
So I know you it was getting cold there for a little bit, but now I hope spring is upon you.
It is. It is. And all of its wonderful pollen.
You're like, damn it.
I know it. So it hits my wife a lot harder than it does me, but.
Well, that's all right. Well, I hope you all are getting through it. And, man, I'm so honored to have you on the show. I created this platform to get artists like you on it. And you and I go way back, man. You and I worked at Guitar Center 20 years ago, and we couldn't stop talking about music, songwriting. We just hit it off right away. We've been like that ever since. We were talking about music even like a couple hours ago.
Yeah.
I want to know the moment of zen. This is one of my favorite questions on this show. What was the moment of zen for you that made you want to become a musician?
Well, the irony is that moment was in the very room that I'm sitting in.
Oh, I got chills. All right.
Dude, so this is my little home studio here. I mean, every home studio has a ceiling fan, right?
Right.
You know.
That's true.
But I guess there's my baby Grant
behind me. Yeah.
But so this was my parents built this house, and I when they got divorced, it was sold. But I grew up here, and you know, I used to always joke if I ever had Matchbox 20 money, I'm gonna show up with a checkbook, knock on the door, and just go, just tell me the number I'm writing down, and because I want the house. And lo and behold, I didn't even have to make Matchbox 20 money to do it. So
that's awesome.
But after my parents divorced, my dad was here for about a year, and I was 13. I came up from the garage steps, come up into this room, which was at one time a formal living room, back when they, you know, had the formal sitting room, and then you had the den. You know, this was where the furniture was that I wasn't allowed to sit on.
So we have a room like that too.
so when my mom and I moved out of this house, she took all this furniture. So this was just an empty room, but it's got floor to ceiling windows. And my dad would sit in here in the afternoon and play his guitar. And I grew up loving music. And so if it was happening, I was at the foot of it. And I came up from being outside one day, and dad was sitting here and he's playing the chords to Be What, a song called If I Were a Carpenter by Johnny Cash.
And I love that song.
Yeah, it's just a 7/4. He knew a few of those words, and he knew some of the words for Fire and Rain by James Taylor. So he had this little medley that he did. And when I heard it, I said, I want to do that. And I said, I just want to learn to do that. I don't need to learn anything else. And my dad just giggled and said, okay. What's super cool is now the spot is just that way. And I have the guitar hanging on the wall that I learned to play.
Oh, man. I got chills again, man.
And it's hanging right where he was sitting.
That's awesome. And he was a performing musician, right? Wasn't he?
No. I mean, he was quite a performer. For anybody that knew my dad would say he's quite the performer. But it wasn't necessarily music. But he loved to play, and he'd have friends over all the time to play music in the living room. But he never did it professionally.
And was he like your first teacher? Did he show you chords?
Man, yes. He showed me D, C, and G back then. I'm adjusting my chair.
That's all right.
He had, like, I guess all parents, you know, they don't have any patience with teaching their kids anything. And so what I would do, there was a guy named Dwight Hamrick that played in band. My dad worked for the state of Georgia, and they had a little, what they called the state band. It was all a bunch of state employees would get together and, you know, play. Was a guy named Dwight, was a really great singer, guitar player, he put together chord books for everybody. And so he'd have the lyric, and then he'd have, you know, on page 19 was "I've Never Been to Spain" by Three Dog Night. Well, Hoyt Axton, I think, was a Hoyt Axton song. So I'd look at that, and I'd go at the table of contents, and it'd have number page 19, okay, and it had the chord chart beside it. So I'd look in a chord book, and I'd find out what chords I didn't know, and that was it.
And then you started, you know, piecing songs together, covers, or did you immediately start writing out of the gate?
So no. So immediately I just started learning everything I could learn, cover songs. I wrote my first song when I was 15. And
that's young, man. That's amazing.
Yeah. And matter of fact.
That's awesome, dude.
Remember these?
That's awesome. So what did you do it on a 4-track?
No. This is all done on a cassette recorder. Wow. I just played it in the bedroom. These are my high school originals.
That's awesome. You got to transfer those, man.
That's why they're sitting here. Okay. So I need to do that. But it was, none of the songs, I don't know if I want to transfer them. I don't know if I want anybody to ever hear them. But the thing was, I was a big, like, there was a Travis Tritt, country artist, was real popular about that time. And I was a guy that if I bought a record, man, the first thing I did is I put it in. But then I immediately opened up all the liner notes. And Travis, he sang it, he played it, but he also, his name was on the majority of the songs.
Yep.
So I just assumed that if I'm going to play music, I have to write songs too.
Wow. So you took on that responsibility at that young?
Yes. I just thought that was what you do. I just thought, well, when you learn to do this, you make up your own songs. And ultimately that is of the singer, songwriter, guitar player is the songwriting that is, what I fell in love with the most.
And would you say Travis Tritt was like the first songwriter that made you kind of fall in love with writing songs, or would you say it was somebody else?
It would have to be James Taylor.
Oh man, good choice. Really good choice.
When I heard Fire and Rain, I said, I want to play guitar to play that. And so the joke was on me because my dad was playing it wrong. And so when I, so back then you could buy a cassette that had two albums on one cassette. So I ran out to the Record Bar was the name of it, and bought a cassette, and it was Sweet Baby James on one side, Mudslide Slim and the Blue Horizon on the other. And I played Fire and Rain, and I'm playing along with what I think, oh man, I know the song now. Right. And it's in the key of C, and I've learned it in D. And there's a few chords that are left out. And so, for whatever reason, I flipped the cassette over when Fire and Rain was done just to see what was on the other side. And there was a song called Machine Gun Kelly, D, C, and G.
And you're like, this is perfect. I know this.
I mean, And Machine Gun Kelly, if you've ever heard that song, it's very similar to Fowler Carpenter.
Well, and you know what? With those three chords, too, you realize how much of the American songbook and really, like, across the globe, you've learned just with those three chords, because there's so much music with just those three chords.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, 100%. Sweet Home Alabama, Can't You See?
Right.
Shadow Days.
Tons of Bob Dylan. I mean, there's every Bob Dylan is that, you know, so there's just many. And did you start with any like classic rock? Did you kind of like dive into country?
I grew up loving country music and bluegrass, Southern gospel, because that's what my family played. And so when I started getting into guitar, then what comes along that was sort of all the guitar songs. Well, Sweet Home Alabama, obviously. So when I was 14, I was in Maine with my cousins for Christmas. And one of them gave me a Lynyrd Skynyrd cassette that was the first two records. It was pronounced Lynyrd Skynyrd on one side, Second Helping on the other. And I was like,
what is this?
Whoa, you know? And so that was as rock and roll as I got, you know? Right. And if I had to, like, sort of looking back on it now, the thing about, especially Lynyrd Skynyrd, is they had the narrative approach to songwriting that I loved about country music.
Story.
And when I, and when I look at everybody, artists that I love, they're all narrative, cinematic in their lyrics, you know, and ultimately that's what I'm drawn to.
What I loved about Lynyrd Skynyrd too, it's like that Southern rock thing. It's still like such a great ingredient, no matter what kind of music you listen to. When you listen to Southern rock, it just has a vibe. It immediately pulls you, and there's no better like sound to me when it's done right, you know?
Well, unless you come from here. And so, I mean, this was the interesting thing is, and I was thinking about this the other day, and how sort of stunted my growth was as a writer. And when I lived out in Los Angeles, this was a thing that changed it. So, you know, when I, like being from here, I started playing and I had a band at 16. We were just a little cover band, but I mean, we had 6 or 7 originals and we were a sort of a country, you know, I was on the more Southern rock kind of honky tonk kind of side of country. Travis Tripp was a Southern rock guy that, you know, was in country too. So, but I love Waylon Jennings. And so that sort of edgier, you know, it's got a grit to it. Country was my thing. I'm not a body like a back road kind of guy.
Yeah. Such great,
but I have a totally interesting take on that record. If we make it that far, for Radio Land out there, I'm from a little town called Milledgeville, Georgia, and I know most of you guys never heard of that. But
I have because I visited you out there.
So if you are headed south out of Atlanta, Georgia, and you get to Macon, you take a left, drive 30 miles.
You're
in my house.
When I came out to see you, you took me to Macon, Georgia.
Uh-huh.
Capricorn, and you and I are both huge Allman Brothers fans.
Yes.
We'll get to that.
Hey,
still one of my favorite things I've ever done, man.
Well, so growing up in Milledgeville, we're so close to Macon, and we had, you know, the Allman Brothers, Marshall Tucker, Wet Willie. You know, Capricorn Records was housed there. So the Southern rock thing is very much steeped in my DNA. Right. And it's really tough to get around it. And I fought it for so many years, but because there for a while, it seemed to carry this sort of elementary view among my peers. So like as a guy, like I was more interested, and this is where there again, I stunted my own growth as an artist. I was so into being, I wanted to be a songwriter, or a musician's musician. You know, I wanted all the other songwriters and guitar players in my peer group, I wanted their respect. Right. I wasn't focused on the audience loving me. And I just had it backwards, really. You know?
Well, no, I mean, there's definitely a fine line where you definitely want both. I mean, you want the crowd appeal, but you do also want the respect of your peers and colleagues. That's
But, you know, what I didn't realize then was my peers were not buying tickets.
Right.
Because they're out there doing the same thing. Right.
Right.
So, but that's, I mean, I'm not regretful. My musical path has really gone the way I've dictated. I've done most of it on my own terms. So I fought being Southern rock for a long time.
I didn't know.
And so when I lived out in Los Angeles, I was it kind of clicked. There was a certain thing out there when I, you know, that started kind of happening to me and how people were reacting to me, should I say, that was different than I sort of experienced them in a way. And what I realized it was the Southern thing is just in me. It just comes out. I don't control it. It's just who I am. Right. And that's when the light bulb came on for me. And when I left Los Angeles, I came home and like, I just decided I wasn't going to put a governor on the kind of song, my songwriting, which I used to do that. I'm like, oh, no, that's a country song. Or no, I'm not doing that. You know, around here, that was old hat, you know. But I'm out in LA and the Southern thing about how I sing or how I play or any of that is foreign right. there because right. it's not natural.
It's not in our DNA like it is.
Right. Other, you know? So it gave me a sauce that made me a little bit, it made me stand out a little bit or made me unique, whatever you want to, however you want to define that. And
you know, so when you came to LA, did you feel like you were like trying to find or follow a trend? Cause like, I think when you came here, it was very acoustic songwriter driven in the pop market.
So, when I moved to Los Angeles, I've moved out there for a specific project. If you remember a movie called Varsity Blues,
yeah,
there was a guy named the character was Billy Bob. The actor's name was Ron Lester. Well, Ron and I were friends, and he was talking. He had a contact at Capitol through the soundtrack for that movie, and he had lost a bunch of weight, and so he was figuring out how to reinvent himself, and because. Nobody recognized him. He went from 508 pounds to 220.
Wow.
And so people would say, oh, are you somebody? You know, and so he was trying to figure out a new thing. And so he, you know, and he could carry a tune. He wasn't, he wasn't George Strait, but there's a whole lot worse out there now, you know. Yeah. And yeah. So he had the shortest shtick of where he came from and who he was professionally. And he was going to try to get something going. And he asked me to come out and sort of be a part of that from as a songwriter. And
I never knew this. I never knew this. It's amazing.
It didn't go very far, but, and at the end of the day, I mean, like Ron, God bless him, is passed on. But I think it was he was going through a season in his life where he was trying to figure some things out. And so he was just kind of throwing darts at the wall or, you know, just seeing what stuck maybe. I got there and it just, it sort of didn't develop. And so I found myself going, oh, let me regroup. That's how I wound up at Guitar Center and figuring out, okay, what am I doing next? So, and then I just had to go out and, you know, play some rooms and try to get something going. And so there's the LA.
Well, what I love too, and we became friends, I think, right away. I just remember.
Yes.
You know, I think I'd seen Mayer and I saw David Ryan Harris open for him on a side stage. And you came up to me and we were already friends and you were like, hey, man, what are you doing tonight? And I was like, I might go see this guy named David Ryan Harris. And you were like, dude, I was just about to invite you. He's a good friend of mine. Let's go tonight. It's at the Temple Bar. And I was like, awesome. And I was like, this guy likes all the same stuff. This is awesome. So we went and saw him. And then you introduced me to him. And I was just amazed that you guys knew each other. And then, you know, you just were in this songwriting scene in Atlanta and in Georgia. And I was also like, man, I was always wondering. I don't think I've ever asked you. Coming from Georgia and coming from that songwriter scene, what did you think of? Because I mean, I'm from LA, but there's easily so many impressions I have about this city and that scene. What was your impression of the music or rock or songwriter scene in LA? And don't hold back.
No. So, unfortunately, I didn't really discover the nooks and crannies of it until right before I left. And so I was still wading through, and I don't mean this derogatory. There's probably a better word, but I was, you know, you start at the bottom.
Right.
And you go, right. So I'm in cream rises. So I was trying to be the cream that was rising. So I'm wading through the bottom rung. I'm doing all the open mics. I'm doing all that stuff. So, you know, I'm trying to work my, you know, the night before I left LA, I played, I believe it was the, is it called the Acoustic Playhouse?
Yeah, that it's not there anymore, but yes, I remember that.
Where is that at? I know it's over by the Playboy Mansion. What's the name of it? Westwood.
Yeah. You're talking about Westwood Bruco?
Yes, that's it. Sorry. That's it. Right by the movie theater. But I played there the night before I left, and it was like a packed house. I mean, they were loving everything I was giving them, and I was like, wow. You know, but, you know, the reason I left was my dad had gotten cancer. And I just like, man, I just can't, you know, I'm a family guy. I couldn't be 3,000 miles away from my pops while I went through that. And so I always felt like, oh, I'll come back. And it just sort of didn't make sense. By the time dad got in the clear and all that, I sort of started over again. And I just thought, well, I mean, I'll just stay put.
Well, I mean, you know, what's awesome is like you definitely made inroads and were, you know, getting like gigs and all kinds of places all over Georgia. And you were kind of making records. I remember did you do your record? I think we were talking about that cover, the one with the painting.
Yes.
That was in Georgia. You didn't do that in LA, did you?
Correct. So that record was done at the old Capricorn Studio.
Wow.
Which
I know what that was like, because we talked a little bit briefly about it and you reminded me and I was like, what? You know, tell me what that is like.
I mean, obviously it goes without saying, it's great to go make a record there. My very first record I'm making in the studio. We're one of my favorite bands, or a couple of my favorite bands. I love the Marshall Tucker Band.
Oh yeah.
I've got more in common with Marshall Tucker than I do with the Allman Brothers, in all honesty. Because they have a countryer thing going on, and they, you know, they made a bunch of records in that same room I got to make my first record in. I mean, that was
wild.
And I got there was a small independent label there that wound up signing me out of that first record. So, man, I got to go in the attic and see all the stuff that had just been packed away and not gone through in decades from the Capricorn era. I mean, there's a telegram announcing Otis Redding's death.
Wow.
That was up there. A copy of the original telegram. I think it's at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame now, but I mean, that was something that was just in boxes, a bunch of outtake slides from photo shoots, things like that. So this was really neat.
Was it big? What was the room like, the tracking room?
It was, I think, almost identical to how it was when, almost identical when the Allman Brothers were there. Awesome. And the curtain in the control room was original to the 70s.
Wow.
The back curtain behind where the drums were set up was this little hardwood section, and that was where Greg's organ sat. So all the cigarette burns. In the floor of Greg's.
Wow. Chills, man.
Man. It's cool. And I mean, I wound up doing that record there, and I've done some other projects there. I played on some other people's projects and things. And it's super cool. Love that room.
And it's like a museum. You're kind of like walking into a time vault a little bit.
Well, now, back then it was not.
Wow. And did you record a tape or was it all digital then?
We did ADAT back then.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, they had the 2-inch tape, but it just wasn't economical for a 20-year-old to go in there and make a record on 2-inch tape.
Right. And so what, you transferred it to Pro Tools or something after you recorded?
No, they mixed it right there. And like even then, man, during mixing, hey, you got those faders? Okay, you ready? Here we go. And then, you know, I mean, like it was kind of like the old school tape mixing, like, you know, all right, we're going to go here to here. All right, ready? And go. You know?
So, you must have been like, what? Okay.
It was great.
And how many songs did you do, and how long did it take?
I did. So I did 10 or 11 songs. And, you know, I think it was done and mixed in 6 days.
Man, and how old were you?
20.
Wow.
20 to 21.
What an amazing room for you to walk into and record and work in at 20. That is.
Yeah. And then when the independent label signed me, I went back, and then I was in a position to then look at the record, and there was a song on the record that I was like, oh, that one doesn't fit. And it was this kind of bluesier tune that just, it didn't sit with the rest of the stuff. So I pulled it, and I had another song that was a newer tune that fit perfectly. So we went back and did another 3 days to do that. Then that's 3 days of recording mixing.
That's amazing that you had the foresight to kind of like see, this song sticks out like a, you know, sore thumb. Let me change it. What made it? Was it the style, or was it just like everything had a vibe and this one just didn't fit with any of
them? Probably a little bit of both. Stylistically, it just didn't fit to me. It was a cool tune, and but it was just like the album was flowing nice and it hit there. I couldn't find a place to put it in the record, in the track listing, to make it go, all right, there's a complete thought.
And, right.
You know, so I always thought, oh, I'll just release it as a outtake or something. And I never did anything with it.
Well, you know, what I always have respected about you, and this is a huge compliment, whenever you make a record, you really take it on like a songwriter and an artist should. You make sure it's like recorded with the best personnel, with the best people, and you take your time to write the songs, arrange the songs, and really work it out with your band, so that when you walk into the studio, you know kind of like what your vision is for the song. A lot of people don't do that. And I think it's crazy that people don't, because they'll just walk in and try to wing it. But I love that you think about it kind of like a chef. It's like you don't just walk in knowing, okay, we're going to wing it. You've planned almost as much as you can, and you leave a little bit of room for some magic. But you know the vision of the song, what the direction is.
Yes, and sometimes to a fault. Sometimes to a fault, like it.
That's all.
Sometimes I get in my own way, I think, by having too much of that vision. And I'm very fortunate as a songwriter, and I know that you know this, or any other songwriters out there, when you're writing, you know, hopefully you're hearing, oh man, that drum's going to do this right here. It's gonna feel great, you know, or the bass player's doing this, and I'm gonna put, you know. I have those visions, but I have people around me, especially my bandmates, that I can go, hey guys, I'm gonna share with y'all what I'm hearing. And if you're not feeling that, then I want to hear what you're hearing.
Right.
And we always, you know, wind up at a really good place with not a whole lot of fanfare in regards to disagreement, you know. But it was, sometimes I will get a little too far in the weeds with sort of the with all the, you know, sort of planning and over, you know, thinking these songs and making this statement instead of just going, let's go in and play a little bit, you know. Right. I would love the opportunity to go, hey, I've got these batch of songs and I got these batch of ideas, let's just go in there and see what happens.
Yeah,
without having an arrangement necessarily in mind. Let's go in there and play it. So we'll take.
I don't think I could ever do that.
No. Well, I mean, I would love to do that. I mean, I don't know that I'm a guy that could be successful with that.
Right.
But I think it would be great to, as an exercise, to be able to do that. And that, so I mean, that's sort of what makes me want to do it.
Well, speaking of records, what do you want to play us first?
Well, good. So, real quick, the lead up, we'll do a little bit of rain first. But so, speaking of that, the record I made when I came home from LA, it's called Living with the Truth. This song's on it. And that's Goodstein on the drums.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. And oh, my goodness, I cannot His name escapes me. He was a bass player.
I know, you're talking about. I know exactly who you're talking about.
I met him at Guitar Center.
Yep, that's right. Yep. He was upstairs. Yes.
And so, yeah, he worked in operations. But he, so I flew Goodstein, and he had moved back to New York at this point. So I flew them in, and I had a batch of songs that I gave to Glenn Matullo. Glenn did the John Mayer Inside Wants Out, did Sean Mullins.
That's right.
The Sugarlands Independent Record. I mean, super guy, great ears, great ideas. And I'd written these songs and I couldn't make sense of it as a statement. I didn't know what kind of statement I wanted to make. I didn't know. I was just in my own way a little bit. And so I just said, Glenn, here's the songs. You decide what we're doing. You decide what goes on the record. I have zero veto power.
Wow. And man, did you trust him because of his experience with Mayer and Sugar Land?
Yes. He made organic records that I loved.
Yeah. And that Mayer record Inside Wants Out. I mean, yeah. It's great. It's such
and great. So I just thought, man, he gets good sounds. And Sean Mullins was probably the big thing because Sean had this element of country about him. But it wasn't country.
Right.
And like, so I dug that. And so, and I wanted to preserve the singer songwriter thing while making a band record. So that was the closest I'd done to that. And, so here's a standout track from that record. And I'll explain a little more after it, sort of what became out of this.
And this one's called Little Box of Rain, right?
It's called Little Bit of Rain.
Little Bit of Rain. Here's Scott Little Band with Little Bit of Rain.
I left California the night that I heard from you. You said, babe, come back home to me. So I loaded up the car, just my clothes and my guitar. I drove all night, but I just couldn't sleep. I didn't want to sleep. Just outside of Denver, burns, and I remember the pretty dress that she had on. And it takes it back there in that little interstate motel. I swear to God, it's been way too long. I've got the wind out of my back and upon my headlights east, drive right through this storm, hoping she'll be waiting on me. There'll be days that we are warmed by the sun. There'll be times that we are overcome with pain. But the one thing I know is if this love's gonna grow, it's gonna take a little bit of rain. Like home, but that girl, she's gone. And that's just the way that it all goes sometimes. I got no doubts And I can figure all this out. And everything is gonna work out fine. I'll be just fine. There'll be days that I am warmed by the sun. There'll be times that I am overcome with pain. My life is gonna grow. It's gonna take a little bit of rain. It's gonna take a little bit of rain.
That was awesome. Man, I got chills. And I know that voice was one of the Indigo Girls, right?
Yes, that's Emily.
Man, you guys sounded great together.
Well, thank you, thank you. I'm quite the fan of that.
That's a great song. You know what? It has a very Counting Crows meets Bruce Hornsby kind of vibe. I loved it. It was great.
Well, and so that song was the only song on the record that wasn't written
you better be
no I'm trying to think of the track listing. There were a couple of songs that were written in LA. Ironically, when I moved to LA, I wrote a song when I got there and I wrote a song when I left, and then and then I was in Atlanta back home for a little bit, and that idea hit me. And I was on the interstate, and I called a friend of mine. I said, "Open an email to me right now, and you type down everything I say." And I did, and it's the lyrics of that song. Wow. And you know, they were just coming faster than I could get them. And so that was the newest song that was on that record, and
a lot of great imagery, man. And your lyrics are so great.
And so I went in, recorded that, and there was that song. It was the first three songs in that record are the three standout songs, you know, that the ones that I only played two songs off that record now, which is that one and a song called Million Miles.
Why do you kind of like you stop believing in songs that you've written in the past, or you just feel like,
I don't know. There's some that just kind of, that record's really almost like a transitional record, because what happens when, so we did the record, it's done, mixed, and I listen to it and the light bulb comes on. This is that moment when I go, it doesn't matter who I want to be musically. Right. I'm hearing who I am.
Right.
And I write country songs. There's no way around it. That's just, when I listen to the material that jumps off of that disc, those are country songs.
Well, so, what I love too about your writing too, it's like, man, you're a lyrics guy, and I love and respect that so much, because it's like, man, you know, JJ Cale's like that too. He's like a very lyrical songwriter, and his melodies are awesome as well, and like yours as well. But it's like the lyrics are telling this story, and you just have to stop whatever you're doing. Even just now, I knew that song because I have it, but it's like listening to it again, it took me back to listening to it like the first time I listened to it, and it took me back to those drives in the South that I've listened to that record on, and it's like, that's my favorite type of song, when it takes me to that place where there's a movie in my mind and the song is creating that movie. I think those are the best songs. They will forever be the best songs. And that's why I respect your songwriting as a craft, you know, because you're very good about the real estate of words and what you're saying.
Well, and I appreciate that. That song does that for me too. And I'm right back sitting in my car coming up, you know, saying those words on the phone, I'm snapped back to where I was emotionally, you know. And it's not a longing thing, but it's a wow, man. I was pretty heartbroken. Right. And I was going through a horrible heartbreak at the time, and that's where and that is the story of that, and sort of feeling like, you know, at the time it was, we didn't work out because I moved to LA,
right,
and then and ironically, you met her first.
I think so.
You did. Yes. When I came to interview at the Guitar Center, she was milling around.
That's right.
And she goes, "Oh, my boyfriend."
I remember that.
And she goes, "My boyfriend knows John Mayer."
Yeah, that's right.
I got to meet him. but anyway, it was, you know, in this, there was a part of me that was like, "Well, I'm coming back. Maybe we could rekindle this. Maybe, you know." And that wasn't to be the case. I mean, obviously, LA is not why it ended. It ended because its time was up, you know. But I mean, that song reminds me of those things. And I mean, that's the first time I've heard that song in a minute. As far
isn't
as
it, isn't it weird how songs can be this like emotional time capsule.
Yeah,
like, and you can not feel those things or remember them, but as soon as you hear it, it's like sensory overload, you know.
You know, and I mean, I have a 19-month-old kid now, and man, I can't wait till she gets to go discover Dad's lyric books.
Yeah.
You know, and go, ooh, Dad, you know, and get to, share those time capsules with her, you know, and she's in some of those, you know. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's the beauty. Tell me a little bit about your creative process. Do you start with words? Do you start with a title? Do you start with like a groove on guitar, chords?
It's always a lyric idea.
Mm.
There are a few times, and, you know, I carry one of these.
Right.
I'm old school. Right. I want to write it down. You know, there's a thing that's super cool to me about, you know, one day my daughter will have those books and it's my handwriting. I don't know. Maybe that'll be important.
Exactly. You know? Yes.
But also when you spoke of the economy of words, if I have to take my time with this thing, right. And then I'm editing in process. You know, nowadays we have the phone, so I can just. But when I sit down to write it down, my editing is happening. So before maybe I write that word, I've already changed it. And so that's you know, that's kind of a neat process to do. And it's also a thing that keeps me in it. I find that now I'm a little bit lazier as a songwriter because I can just throw it in my voice memo and I'll come back to it.
Right. Yes.
Joe Pug has a great podcast called The Working Songwriter, and he goes, you know, this is not a song, this is not a song, and you know what we're all looking for is an ironclad excuse to actually put off writing songs, and it's so true, you know.
I love that,
but yeah, it's all, you know, it's generally a title. It's very Nashville. It's very Nashville the way.
Is it like an observation? Is it something that it's like the narrative is like very first person? Are you thinking outside of yourself? Are you kind of like thinking, making up a situation, or is it all very autobiographical?
I won't say all are biographical, but I have to tie it to me.
Right.
To get it, you know, to get inside of it. And right. There are things where somebody will say something and I'll like, ooh, you know, or, you know, there's, you know, or I don't know, I'll maybe have an idea and then it leads me to a title. But the majority of times I write from a hook, and that's country music. And then if you go to Nashville, it used to be how it was. I mean, now they got track guys, so sometimes things will start with a track. But I think 99.99% of the time, the guy's on the way to the right, he's either got a hook book where he's got song titles, or in his phone now, we have song titles, or man, we, you know, maybe come up with something on the way to the right, you know, and, right. And then you just start working that title over to find out, who, I mean, what's the best way to tell that story, you know, and
you start
if you're co-writing, how does that story relate to me? Versus how does it relate to you and so that's the fun of collaboration is the perspective. I mean, I'm still a writer that I write a lot of songs on my own,
right?
But I love to co-write too. And the more I co-write, the more I write on my own. Like once that muscle is working, man, it just doesn't shut off for me.
I love that. And do you start like, okay, if you have a title and you have words, do you start with chords from there or do you go straight into melody and then try to piece chords?
So my weakest part of the songwriter is melody, you know, sort of. So if I have a title, then I try to go to, all right, what does this sound like? Right. So I'll give you an example. I had this new song. And it's heavy-handed, and it's kind of dark, and it is. So I thought, man, what does this sound like? And this is a story. It's a song I thought I had the demo. This is gonna be one of the ones I was gonna send you, but I wound up not having it to send to you on this computer. But what it was this, you know, for whatever reason, the word methamphetamine hit me one day. Like the meter of the word, the syllables, I don't know. There's something a little sexy about it. There's something intriguing about it. It just started with the word. And then I thought, and that word came out of one day. That thing I'd said that, you know, methamphetamine is the cancer of a small town. Wow. And so I thought about the word, then I thought about what I just said and what did that mean? And so I decided, I think as an exercise, I think it'll be tricky to rhyme that and figure out, you know, so I started thinking about, the barrier of entry for that, you know, for people who get into that drug. I mean, we all know how horrible it is. And,
right.
And how filthy it is. I mean, what you make it out of, right?
Right.
So I decided I would write it from the perspective of somebody who had come home from war. And it's a little tricky because I used sort of how they, in the 60s, you know, you came home from Vietnam, they called you a baby killer, you know, and they right. wouldn't give you a job. And so I sort of used some of that. And so this guy comes home from war and is kind of got to have a job and got to figure out how to survive. And so it's like the lyrics, like, I got a spot in the woods where nobody looks for me, rundown shack under an old oak tree. I got hydrochloric acid, ether and Sudafedrine. I'm cooking it up, methamphetamine.
Wow.
The war spit me out, sent me home a broken man, and folks around here were all out of helping hands. So I did what I had to do when times got lean, because life's a bitch, methamphetamine.
Wow.
And
let's pause right there, because I want to play another one of your songs.
Okay.
What do you want to play us next?
I guess we'll stick with the we'll do them in chronological order of appearance. Well, this is Good Love Dies.
Good Love Dies by Scott Little.
It's cold and rainy on the road tonight. Fog slits in my headlights. I gotta put some miles between this heartache and me. Hoping she might change her mind before I make the county line. I bet by now I'm a memory. cry. Now I'm running, running from a lonesome sand. She took my name, I took her for granted. This just ain't the way that I planned it. Wish I could just turn this car around. There's nothing left to do but drive. Guess I've got myself to blame. Yes, I do. It's over. I can see it in her eyes. Ripped out her heart and left her to cry. Now I'm running, running from a lonesome sound. She took my name, I took her for granted. It's just a
amazing. Scott, we're running out of time, but I want to make sure people can find you. Where can people find you online if they want to kind of combine your music?
We're definitely on like the iTunes, Spotify's, I think all that stuff. Scott Little, and you can search Scott Little Band. I'm on Facebook. Scott, you can search Scott Little Band. Scottlittle.com. If you want the 2009 update, there it is. I haven't done anything with that in a long, long time. So
well, I'm gonna have you back. And you know what? I'm doing another record, and we're gonna do a cover of an Allman Brothers song, and I'm gonna have you on it. So
oh, that'd be great.
On another record, man. But dude, you're such a tremendous artist. You're such a tremendous friend of mine, and you're such an incredible songwriter. And can't say enough great things about you and your music, dude. You're just a badass. So
well, likewise, brother.
And hugs to the fam, man.
Yes.
I love you like a brother, man. I really mean it. And thanks for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood, dude.
Man, thanks for having me. Thank you, Sam, for everything. And y'all take care.
On behalf of Sam, myself, and the rest of the LA Talk Radio, and Scott Little, check out his music, scottlittle.com. We'll see you guys next week.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.